We learn a lot when we discover what someone thinks about the church. What somebody thinks about the church tells us exactly what that person is thinking about Christianity. There is, of course, much more to Christianity than simply our experience of the church. Christian faith is about much more than what happens on a Sunday or on a couple of nights a week. Nevertheless, what happens in churches, in a church like this, speaks volumes about the kind of Christian understanding that is at work. It tells us how people are thinking about God, how they're relating themselves to the truth of His Word, how they see the world, how they think about human corruption, or if they think about it at all, how they think about the gospel, how they think about the poor and dispossessed, their own generation, money, affluence, career, time, the future. You learn all that from how people react to the church. So it's a good thing every now and then for those of us who are in the church to stop and reflect on what it all means to us. What's my part in all this? How important an aspect of my life is all this? Well, today is Partnership Sunday at All Souls, a chance for us to reflect on some of what it means to be a member here. Now, if you're a visitor, I'm glad you're here. Do please listen in, because some of these things that apply to us will apply equally to the church to which you are committed in your local place. For some perspective on these things, we're turning to a lovely song of the Old Testament church, Psalm 126, a lovely psalm in one of the loveliest groups of psalms, the 15 Songs of Ascents, from Psalm 120 to 134, sung probably on the journey up to Jerusalem at the time of the great pilgrim feasts of Passover, Harvest, and Tabernacles. A chance for the pilgrims to reflect on the greatness of a God who delivers, who restores, who puts things right, who does great things, a God who's able to replace tears with laughter, who promises that hard sowing will more than be compensated by abundant reaping. This is a God we want to do business with on Partnership Sunday. Psalm is short, it's beautifully crafted, it's profoundly encouraging, and it's wonderfully realistic. It speaks to us, despite its ancient context, as if it were written today. And that's the way the Bible works. It affirms God's surpassing greatness and our dogged efforts. It acknowledges the extraordinary highs and lows that mark Christian service, and we know that only too well. It's a challenge to our complacency, that lifestyle that the late Malcolm Muggeridge dubbed licking the earth. Ego, carnality, materialism. And it's a tonic for our tired arms and legs and minds and souls as we contemplate God's ultimate triumph. So you're in for a feast. This is a psalm to enlarge your vision and stiffen your resolve. It calls us to reflect on just what it means to do and be church, the pilgrim people of God, not now journeying to some earthly Jerusalem, but to the life and worship of the new creation. Well, let me suggest four themes held carefully in balance by the psalmist, which may help us tonight. And here's the first: the balance between memory and hope, verses 1 to 3. The background to the psalm is probably the Babylonian exile. God's people had grown useless in his hands, and they had had to learn some hard lessons. But there, behind the barbed wire, so to speak, of exile, the covenant people had returned to their senses. And there was restoration. And after you've spent 70 years as a stranger in a strange land, stripped of your true identity and culture, wondering where God was and what he was doing, that feels good. Restoration feels good. God has lost none of his power. He's still there. He's still working. And there's a bit of a dream come true quality about this. Do you see that in verse 1? Those prophets who had dreamt their dreams, who'd spoken of a bigger reality, were right after all. This isn't a game in which we're involved. These pilgrims were not prisoners of history. They don't need to adopt a sort of victim mentality. No, they're back in Zion. They're more than conquerors. People of God, stand tall again in their true dignity. And as we in the church look back, remembering what God has done to deliver, to rescue, to preserve, don't we discover again the power of hope in a remarkable way? No, of course, our captivity, our exile is not a physical or geographical one. No, it's a spiritual one, but we still need God's rescue, and we've experienced it, haven't we, if we're his? Look at the response to rescue then in verses 2 and 3. Our mouths were filled with laughter, our tongues with songs of joy. Then it was said among the nations, the Lord has done great things for them. The Lord has done great things for us, and we are filled with joy. Isn't that remarkable? How much more do we feel the depth and reality of this rescue, this side of the cross? And you know, this is no English reserved, it's quite nice to be a Christian point. No, this is much bigger. These phrases point us to an explosion of joy. They heap terms upon terms to convey something of the fullness and intensity of the joy and hope in a God who restores. There's laughter. There's sheer delight. You know, in the church, we worry all the time about being laughed at. The psalmist says here, we should be the people doing the laughing. It's okay to feel things about being a Christian. Just don't go overboard if you're British. You remember the third and fourth lines of that lovely song, All People That on Earth Do Dwell. Him serve with mirth, his praise forth tell. Come ye before him and rejoice. There's an explosion of joy here. And this is the first question tonight. Is this us? Are we saying this personally, collectively, at All Souls? The Lord has done great things for us, and we're filled with joy. You know, we need supremely to be a group of gospel-astonished people who know that there's something to party about. And, you know, that's ultimately the only motivation for service and church life that works. You're a Christian. You've got a new identity. You're in Christ. Christ is in you. Let all your doing and your work and your effort emerge from that wonderful status. It'll not work the other way around, you know. We need to be people who wake up in the morning saying, I'm redeemed. I'm redeemed. I can't believe I'm one of God's children. I can't believe God has placed his love on me. I can't believe he has called me to his work. No, my life and work aren't always easy, but I'm redeemed. No, the relationships with people around me don't always work the way they should, but I'm redeemed. Yes, I live in a world that is broken and does not operate as it's intended, but I'm redeemed. Yes, I face personal and ministry disappointment almost every day of the week, but I'm redeemed. I'm made alive. And, you know, the place where gospel-astonished people get together is the church. For hard as it may be to believe, as Ephesians 3:10 makes clear, the church is God's marvelous handiwork, demonstrating his manifold wisdom to the universe. And, you know, whatever the church's limitations and weakness, she is still gloriously more wonderful than any of the alternatives you can imagine. And getting together like this on a Sunday, we come to the very outskirts of heaven, don't we? As we catch just a glimpse, a taste of what will someday be permanent and eternal. And working properly, verse 2, do you see that? The world can't miss this. The world sees it. The nations see it. Do you remember that moving little piece a couple of years back by the journalist Matthew Paris? After his exposure to some gospel-transformed work in Malawi, what he saw, he wrote, confounds my ideological beliefs, stubbornly refuses to fit my worldview, has embarrassed my growing belief that there is no God. That's what the church does when it's working well. It confounds people. They can't make it out. God expects his restoring work to be seen. Let me be personal for a moment. I get to my 40th year in All Souls this autumn. I arrived as a law student here in 1972. But, you know, being in this church, this amazing place, and now with my wife and family here too, has been, I tell you, the biggest experience of my whole life. You know, again, some of you won't believe this, but it has been far, far better than any measure of success in career or any other thing of that sort. So I know at first hand here that the Lord has done great things for us in the life and work of All Souls. I'm thankful for over 100 years of godly rectors who've led All Souls. And behind that, I'm thankful for the evangelical Anglican tradition in which we've been placed. And behind that, I'm thankful for the reformers who changed the church when it was needed to bring it back on track. And before that, I'm thankful for the church fathers. And before that, for the apostles. We stand in a great tradition. Now, we felt the pain of John Stott's departure. How we miss him. What we owe him. But, you know, the great men who've done so much for us are not coming back, but their God is still with us. To dazzle us again with his power to transform and to make a church go ahead into a new age. And that's where this psalm starts, not with an exercise in nostalgia. No, but with an exercise of memory, recalling just how good God is. It's a call to thankful remembering. That's our first point. There's no surer ground for hope in a church than what God has done in the past, in our own lives and in the life of the church family. The second little heading that I want you to think about for a moment is God's work and ours. It's there in verse 4. You see that? God's work and ours. The psalmist moves from the past to the present. He moves from the what will it be like question of future hope to the what is it like now question of today. Does it strike you as odd that the psalmist both celebrates restoration and prays for restoration? Because the Hebrew word in verse 1 and verse 4 is the same in each case. Restore. It has happened. And yet somehow we still need it. Isn't that extraordinary? There's always an already and a not yet in church life. And we know that in experience. You see, every church which has known the favor of God is tempted to believe we've done enough. We're getting it right. All will be well. But, you know, in a generation, a congregation, a missionary society, even a great historic denomination can lose its way and sink back into captivity, growing utterly inconsequential, losing its true identity, no longer inhabited by the living God. So the true people of God know the danger, and they can't contain themselves, and they're crying out a big prayer in verse 4, a big prayer. Do you see it? A prayer for the whole people of God. Restore our fortunes, O Lord, like streams in the Negev. And the Negev's that arid desert area in southern Israel stretching down to the Dead Sea. I've stood on Masada, that great site of the battle, and looked out across the Negev. You wonder how anything could ever flourish or survive there. It's an extraordinarily barren area. But just occasionally, in heavy rain, there are flash floods that wash all before them. This is a graphic prayer for the flash flooding of God in our church, in our day. The psalmist is praying that there might be a flood of grace, that the Holy Spirit might work in the church. Are we praying that for all souls? Are we praying that for the Church of England, of which we're a part? Flash flood of grace. Yes, you know, we can plan and market and program and manage, and we should, and the PCC works hard here to do that all the time. We can do all those things to the best of our ability, but only God can grow the church. Only God can impart life. Only God can open eyes. Only God can invigorate congregations. It's His church. And that's both a great comfort, but it's also a great challenge to us to turn to Him, to ask Him to do it. You see, a flourishing church is not a matter of psychological motivation or marketing technique or attractive program planning or aesthetic appeal or generational pandering. It's a matter of God sweeping through our lethargy and despondency and our small-mindedness to do what He loves to do, and that is to bring life and energy and joy. See, no amount of business savvy or organizational wizardry or cultural relevance is a substitute for the amazing, unexpected, uncontrollable, sweeping all before it power of God. Are we praying for that? Is committed prayer part of your partnership with all souls? Getting when you can to the prayer meeting on alternate Tuesdays, using the prayer diary, concentrating during the intercessions on a Sunday, sourcing and using the information available from our program booklet, all those things, praying in terms of verse 4. Do you see that? What a wonderful verse. Restore our fortunes, O Lord. We need to be people of prayer. So, in verses 1 to 3, the psalmist calls us to thankful remembering. Here he surely calls us to passionate praying. But I said God's work and ours, and that brings me to the third little balance here. It's the balance between sowing and reaping, verses 5 and 6. Do you see those verses? Those who sow in tears will reap with songs of joy. He who goes out weeping, carrying seed to sow, will return with songs of joy, carrying sheaves with him. Yes, God gives life, but He works principally through us, through people. That's why the New Testament speaks of the church as Christ's body. Yes, He does at times break in unmistakably and miraculously in seasons of revival. But for a lot of the time, the work of the gospel in the church is about steady, dogged perseverance. See, that's why the farmer metaphor is engaged in verses 5 and 6. Steady, often unglamorous, mucky, sleeves rolled up sort of work. Work where you're not fully in control of the soil conditions, of the weather, of growth rates, of market prices, of disease. Work supremely of faith. You plant and you wait. Because there's no other way. There's nothing else you can do. You can't do it any other way. So if we've had a call to remember, and we've had a call to pray, these verses are surely a call to work, a call to committed working. We need to be prayers and plodders. Do you think it was a miracle a minute for the early church? Hardly, according to the New Testament epistles. They plodded, right foot, left foot, right foot, left foot. They sweated, they suffered, they were pushed around, they toughed it out together, they cooked meals, they swept dusty meeting rooms, they went into dodgy neighborhoods, they visited sick friends, they delivered letters, they wrote books, they prayed and wept and prayed again, and they refused to quit. That's the picture, isn't it, that emerges from the epistles. There was a deep, passionate commitment to do what was required. There was a stepping up to the plate, whatever it cost. See, we need to expect God to work and to commit ourselves to doing something to make that happen. The farmer's the example. He or she works hard and then waits patiently, wondering if the harvest will come. That's our job. That's all there is to do, to work and wait. So the question for us on Partnership Sunday is, are you a worker, a sower? Are you investing for eternity through the life of all souls? See, there's a principle here in these verses, a spiritual principle that Hugh so helpfully took us to this morning. It's a principle that runs through the whole of the Bible. As we sow, so we reap. You know the unhappiest person you're likely to meet in any church? It's the half-hearted Christian, the casual Christian, the lazy Christian. They're often the most unhappy people in churches. It's not the busy people. It's not the people who are getting their sleeves rolled up and who are getting stuck in. No, here is this principle of sowing and reaping, and it runs through the whole Bible. As we work for God, so in an extraordinary way, He honors us. Christian is called to be a contributor and not a consumer in the church. And when the Bible talks of sowing and reaping, it seems to apply this in three areas. And we looked at some of these themes this morning, but it's worth repeating them tonight. First of all, this is applied in the ethical realm. And you see that in a passage such as the one we looked at this morning, Galatians 6:8, for example, where we are told that if we sow to the flesh, we reap corruption. Whereas if we sow to the Spirit, we enjoy life. And, you know, that's precisely what happens when we harbor grudges, or we peddle gossip, or we view pornography, or we're too busy to get out of bed to pray or to come to help somebody, or we wallow in self-pity, or a thousand and one other things, sowing to the flesh. You see, the ways in which we live, the things we do, the habits we indulge in, they all have consequences, and not just personally. They have consequences for each of us in the body. So how are you sowing in terms of Christlikeness? Being an all souls partner is first a call to challenge and help one another in every way we can to lead a Christ-like life. And then the second realm that the Bible applies this sowing and reaping principle is the financial realm. And again, we looked at 2 Corinthians 9, verse 6 this morning. You'll know the passage well. Whoever sows sparingly will reap sparingly. Whoever sows generously will reap generously. That's about money. And your giving at All Souls or anywhere else where you're giving is strongly linked to your spiritual vitality. Because money is an effective way of showing our love to God because it's so much part of us. And it's a way of showing our love to God because it's so much part of us. And we can give it away. We can invest in the things that ultimately matter to God. We can invest for ultimate returns. And, you know, people who do that find, strangely, that it brings authenticity and vitality to our devotional experience. So do you need to discover afresh that the giving experience, the generosity experience, and reconsider your giving? You know, All Souls depends on commitment and generosity of every single one of us here. We can't function without it. We're a bit on the ropes at the moment, to be honest. The ministries simply can't function without generous giving, and many do that already. But we long for a new generation to discover the spiritually liberating dimension of generous giving. And the current broadsheet has a superb article, which I commend to you, about the shape of our finances. Please look at that and reflect what, if anything, it means for you. And then the third dimension of this sowing and reaping applies in the evangelistic realm. We thought too of the parable of the sower this morning in Mark chapter 4. Do you see it's there in verse 6 of our psalm? Do you see that? He who goes out, and the sense of the original is who keeps on going out, who keeps going out. That's the sense. Sowing and reaping. Going out with the seed of the gospel, both in what we say about Jesus and in the thousand acts of love and service to other people through which we show the love of Jesus. All Souls is a wonderful place for outreach and evangelism. We've got some terrific things coming up later this year with the mission in March and then the Olympic program in the summer. But all the time, what better place is there in London to invite someone to hear about Jesus Christ? So are we using these opportunities as best we can? Because the promise of verse 6 is that no faithful effort is ever wasted. You see that? We don't see the full significance of our often pathetic efforts. But we can trust that God preserves their worth by somehow drawing them into His own omnipotent work, sweeping us through history. As we witness, we sow the seeds of the gospel. And as that happens, we're part of something vast and glorious, far beyond the range of our awareness. Well, memory and hope, a call to thoughtful remembering. God's work and ours, a call to passionate praying. Sowing and reaping, a call to committed working. And I've just got time for the final balance. Number 4, tears and joy, verses 5 and 6. The Bible is a wonderfully honest book. And it doesn't hide from us what quite a lot of Christian people know perfectly well, and that is that Christian service is hard quite a lot of the time. It's a little bit like Churchill in the House of Commons in May 1940. I have nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears, and sweat. There's a bit of that about Christian work, to be honest. If you want an easy life, don't get involved in ministry. Keep quiet about your faith at work. Don't plug into church. Above all, don't get involved with people, whatever you do, for it'll hurt. Are you on the fringes of All Souls? Stay there. Stay there if you want an easy life. But, you know, the other side of this, truthfully, is that there is no joy comparable to the joy of seeing God at work in a church or in people's lives. And yet at the same time, there is no work tougher or harder than Christian work. After her death, people were shocked to see some of Mother Teresa of Calcutta's correspondence with her references to dryness and darkness and loneliness and the sense that her ministry was hypocritical. John Stott said once that discouragement is an occupational hazard of Christian ministry. So it is. John's hero, Charles Simeon, wrote to a friend with wonderful English understatement, "Dear brother, we must not mind a little suffering." See, most of my very best moments of the last 40 years have been in this room, to be honest. But so have some of the worst moments of the last 40 years, when there's been dishonesty and failure and setback and issues with no obvious solution. The wonderful thing Psalm 126 does is to assure us that no one who goes out to work in God's field need ever fear futility. You'll never lose out in any ultimate respect through your commitment to Christ. You know, I know that there are people here whose parents, for example, will have said to them, don't throw away your life on this Christian stuff. Get over it. It's just a phase. Don't get too involved. I know that people's parents have said that to them. But do you remember what Jesus said to people who try to cling on to their own lives? Do you remember what he said? See, you'll never lose out in any respect that ultimately matters through your commitment to Christ, even though, as we well know, in some parts of the world, right now, you may lose your freedom or even your life. Helen Roosevere was a missionary of extraordinary courage who served in the Congo, and at one point she found herself in front of a firing squad for preaching the gospel, and she was asked by one of her captors, "Are you scared?" And she replied, "Why should I be scared? There's nothing you can do to me to take my joy away." Well, you know, that's the confidence of verse 6. I've often thought about this sowing with tears point. I mean, there's nothing inherently troubling about sowing, is there? Sowing is not inherently distressing. And indeed, most of the farmers that I know moan a bit about the weather and prices and the horrendous cost of tractors and that sort of thing, but they are fundamentally cheerful people, most of them. Perhaps the flavor of this is more the subsistence farmer who has eaten up most of the crop and there's nothing left to feed the family. And he goes out sowing with tears because he knows that that little bag of grain on the wall that he takes could have fed the family. And indeed, his little pot-bellied children have come to him and have said, "Dad, we've got grain. There it is. Let's get Mother to make it into flour now and let's eat because we're starving." It'd be very tempting for the dad to do that. Be very tempting to take the bag of seeds off the wall, to make flour, to have a meal, to feed the family. But he doesn't do that. Instead, he does the strangest thing imaginable. He says no to his family, and he goes out with tears in his eyes, and he scatters that precious seed in the dirt. Why? Why? Because he believes in the harvest. Because he believes there's something bigger and better and more worthwhile than stuffing his face. He can't expect to rejoice unless he commits to sowing, but boy, does it hurt as he does so. So here's our reflection for Partnership Sunday. Do you need to repent of a complaining, negative spirit? To get hold of the balance between memory and hope, to become a gospel-astonished member of All Souls with a smile on your face saying, "The Lord has done great things for us. He has." Or do you need to hear the call to prayer, to pray more boldly for things to happen at All Souls, for a flash flood of God's grace? Or do you need to stop being a consumer and start being a contributor in time and money and energy and service? John Piper so wisely has written, "The unwasted life is the one that continually puts Christ on display." Do you need the encouragement and the reassurance that in all the tears and frustrations and apparently closed doors and impossible people and difficult situations, there's a bigger purpose and a certainty of an abundant harvest and an ultimate restoration and renewal of all things? I end with just a little story about Karl Barth, one of the great theologians of the 20th century. Some colleagues and a few fellow students got together for his 80th in 1966. Nice things were said about him by many speakers, and Barth was asked to respond. And here's what he said. "If I've done anything in this life of mine, I've done it as a relative of the donkey that went its way carrying an important burden. The disciples had to say to its owner, 'The Lord has need of it.' And so it seems to have pleased God to have used me at this time, just as I was, in spite of all the things, the disagreeable things, that quite rightly are and will be said about me. Thus, I was used. I just happened to be on the spot." Well, All Souls needs you if this is your church. The Lord, too, needs you. We are a company of donkeys, you and I. What was important about that donkey, of course, was not its size or its pedigree or its personality, but rather what it carried or who it carried. The Lord has given us mere donkeys all, here in central London, the responsibility of carrying the precious cargo of the gospel, and through it, nothing less than the hope of the world. Well, may we honor and love our Lord through the life of this church family and not be stubborn old mules.